Hey guys, welcome to this week's Money and Investing Show. This week we are grappling the subject of investor or trader psychology. This whole inner game of mindset mastery is crucial. We'll go through some practical examples of real trades and how mindset can influence the decision making there. We'll also give you some tips and tools to help you smooth things through and learn to rely on the process and not the emotion when it comes to decision making. Make sure you take plenty of notes, but as always, please make sure you take plenty of action. Hey guys, welcome to this week's Money and Investing Show with me, your host, Andrew Baxter, and as always, my offsider and co-host, Mitchell Laurentiel.
Good to be here, AB. Thank you very much for having me. Now, topic of conversation today, a little different to normal. Most of the stuff we talk about, theory, numbers, practical steps, which we'll go on into today, no doubt. We're going to talk about the psychology of investing, though, mastering your mindset.
Look, mindset mastery, investor psychology, trading psychology, whatever label you want to put on it, I would argue is probably the single biggest distinction between success and failure in markets. And yet, as an educator and having spent a couple of decades now teaching people, most people want to dive straight into analysis. How do I find good trades? What technical indicators do I use? What fundamentals do I need to know? What strategy should I apply? And all of those things are incredibly important. But if your mindset's not right, you're never going to discharge your duties as a trader correctly, and you're going to end up blowing up.
Totally. And we can use a lot of the same analogies when it comes to sport. For example, very Darwinian, same as trading by definition. And they say, 80% of the game or 80% of trading is played above the shoulders. And it is true based on what we've seen.
It's crucial. And I think why so many investors and traders sort of shudder to get involved with this is that there's nowhere really to hide. You're quite vulnerable when you start to go into why am I doing things this way? You can't blame it on a setting on an indicator or a data spike. It's down to you. And that self-examination is very, very confronting. So maybe sometimes it's easier just to park that in the drawer and come back to it another time, often never to come back to it and never really fixing the damaged link in the chain, if you will, between success and failure in markets.
Self-reflection's hard, particularly when you've made a mistake and you potentially lost money on an investment. With that, Andy, let's dive into some theory before we go into some real-life examples here, just so our listeners are aware of some of the biases that they're probably experiencing themselves likely at the moment or have. First one that comes to mind to me is the endowment effect.
So the endowment effect is a well-researched piece of psychological undertaking, and that is, or at least the theory behind it, is that when you own something, you treat it differently to something you don't own. There's a stake that you have in it because you've committed funds or a decision towards something. So you start to see the decision-making around that sort of, if you like, sort of wrapped in cotton wool. Good example of this is with your kids. Obviously, you don't have children at this point in time. I've got plenty. And when you're watching them, you could be talking to someone, oh, my kids would never do that. Because of your kids, you see them through a particular lens, yet they're actually doing the very thing you said they'd never do right behind you you're talking to somebody. So you feel differently about it when it's yours. Another silly example of this would be, you might have a mug or a cup at the office that's where you get your morning tea. And if somebody else had the audacity to use that cup, even though it's in the cupboard for everybody to use, you get pretty cranky about
it.
Game
on.
All the cups are the same. The tea's going to taste the same, but you've got a particular relationship. And I know it's insane to talk about this, but that's the reality of how we're programmed as human beings. When something's ours, we feel differently. That can be a real problem in the trading space, because once you're in a trade and you own that trade, if you start to let those emotions overtake the objective signposts that you need to look at to make your decisions, oh, hold on to it, I'm always good at picking this trade, it'll come good, very, very seldom works out. So you've got to be brutal, unemotional, and just have a very, very straightforward plan to follow to avoid that ability to let the endowment effect come in and really corrupt, I think is the term, your decision-making.
Gotcha. Don't get too attached, right? Couple of others I'd like to talk about, over and under confidence. Now, I know we've both experienced both of these, and I can say personally, I was probably overconfident when I was early on, and then you experienced some pretty hard sell-offs through COVID and that kind of thing, and was underconfident from there. Can really cloud your judgment.
It brings again a level of, let's say you were tossing a coin and it was heads three times in a row. And I said, what do you reckon, heads or tails this time? And most people say, well, it's probably going to be heads again because it's in the trend. Yet it's actually a random 50-50. The odds haven't changed, even though it's been heads three times in a row. It could be heads or tails, 50-50 probability. And I think when you've had a good trade or a good run in the market, you can sometimes bring that baggage of, look, I'm on an absolute tear at the moment, so everything I touch turns to gold. And you can go in a little bit cocky, a little bit arrogant, a little bit more, I've got this, rather than letting the process take care of it. So you see, for example, in those scenarios where you're not really waiting for your entry criteria to set up. You're getting in before the B of the bang because you're seeing it big and you've got really good touch on the market. And that can be really devastating. You've got to rely on your process to stop you from doing that sort of thing. So overconfidence is quite tricky. Underconfidence equally, you know, if you've been on the back of a bit of a slacking in the market, you know, you timidly dip a toe. And I'm a huge advocate for scaling up or scaling down when you've had a good or a bad run. If you're not having the best of runs, stopping is very difficult. To restart, but scaling down to smaller position sizes and just keeping the wheels turning on a very, very small basis makes it a lot easier for you to start building that confidence again. Whereas if you've come from being on the sidelines and trying to get up to speed with the game, it doesn't work. So underconfidence means that you might wait for too much confirmation for a trade.
Gotcha.
As opposed to getting in too early.
This leads me on to two others, which are probably similar but slightly different, and that's negativity and positivity bias. So say, for example, you've bought CBA before and you've made some money on CBA. A lot of people automatically think that the next time you trade CBA, you can pick it because you've already had a positive experience. Works the other way too, but not necessarily the case.
Very true. And I think as human beings, we often project our previous experiences onto a lot of scenarios. You know, we see people, for example, that join in our trading community in our ecosystem that have been very, very successful in other business endeavors. And their expectation is that they're going to bring that level of success and expertise into trading. But if this is a new endeavor, you've got to start at the ground floor and build it up. You can't project that into it. And likewise, on the opposite side too. Yeah.
What about loss aversion? Losses loom larger than wins. Mm. That's a saying I heard plenty of times at uni when I covered this, and one thing that I've seen happen a lot.
Mm. Very true. I think there's a significantly bigger emotion attached to a loss than there is a decent amount of emotion and pleasure attached to a win. So we always see, you know, the losses are sort of right up 4K, bright in focus, bright and colored, and your wins are sort of gray and out of focus and fuzzy in the background. And again, it's a phenomenon of human beings. I guess it's our fight or flight mechanism that stems back from maybe when we're in caves. And so, you know, we're very protective of our money. That reptilian part of the brain still works in that way to offer us protection from a threat, and a loss would be seen as a threat. So, you know, that's something that does loom large when you're talking about it, and can overshadow opportunity because, you know, they go in hand in glove. But if you see one bigger than the other, then it's going to create inactivity and ultimately stop you trading.
Indeed. One that is probably the last one we'll talk of as an example before we move on, AB, and that's FOMO. Mm. I've seen that a lot recently, of course, with the market moving the way it has.
Fear of missing out. You know, you want to be on the ride, not watching people on the ride having a great time, and that can often lead to people buying into trends very late in the day. And I think sometimes it's interesting, and I get to this from time to time when I've done some one-on-one coaching or a rehab session with clients, for example, or prospective clients for that matter. And you go, look, the fear of missing out. Why didn't you get on when the signal was sort of triggered? You've left it so late now that you're buying right in at the sort of higher end of the trend. There's a lot of fresh air underneath where you're at, so it's a more risky trade. And chances are if someone's been a little nervous or tentative because of maybe previous losses and they're bringing that negative bias into this particular environment, they've held off for more and more proof that this is a real trend to hook onto. And in doing so, what they're effectively going to do by the time they do squeeze the trigger is get on it totally the wrong time and reinforce that trading is bad because they'll lose money again. So I think sometimes you've got to take a couple of steps back and ask, why is this FOMO creeping in? What stopped you taking the early signal? Where's your confidence at? And starting to break that apart and look at where the deficiencies are in the decision-making process, whether that be the process itself is rubbish or in need of some work, let's not be too harsh, or whether their ability to follow it is rubbish or, should I say, in need of some work. And it's usually in one of those two areas. So if you've spent time building a really nice solid plan, you shouldn't have the confidence to follow it. If you haven't built a plan and you have no discipline, that's a blank canvas. You've got to start again.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, with all of this, it sounds pretty confusing, right? Because we're diving into human biases and emotions and whatnot, which you can't really measure on a spreadsheet or anything like that. However, there are strategies that we know we can utilize to overcome these. The biggest that springs to mind for me is remaining objective and also having a plan. What are your thoughts?
Hello, I agree 100%. You have to have a plan. It's as simple as that, because any absence of a plan means there's no objectivity. You're going off feelings, and that's just a road that leads nowhere good. You know, you might get up in the morning having had a terrible night's sleep, and maybe there was some bad news in the US, and that negativity is now projected across everything you look at. And, oh, this stupid market. And I guess one of the tools, and it's a very basic yet very powerful tool, and most basic tools are powerful, is that notion of journaling, whereby you're able to convey how your decision making is going and articulating where the roadblocks are kind of real time or immediately after the trade. And for when you need some help from your coach, when people come in and they've got notes in their journals, they'll have a look at it, and it quite quickly, it can point you to where the challenge might be. So that whole feeling of having no objectivity and not having a proper plan is a really major issue. Got to do the work first.
Can I add to that as well? I think an important one for people is not agonizing over your positions. So for example, one thing I'd suggest to anyone, particularly people who I coach within our ecosystem, is have a dedicated time each day that's actually set aside to review your open trades. The worst thing you can do is wake up in the morning, check your phone and go, oh no, have a time where you're in a controlled environment. So it's not emotional.
That's exactly right. And yeah, I've seen both ends of the spectrum where you've got people that are really don't really care and are really hands off, which is probably not ideal. And then at the other end of the spectrum, you see someone that perhaps is their first trade, and you go, have you got any, like, can I look at your record keeping on this? And yeah, they've got a printout of the chart and they've got the pen all drawn on it. This is where I got in. These are my notes. And which is all great stuff, but it's also almost overkill because they're checking on it like it's their firstborn, where, you know, everything okay, can't hear them, you know, what's going on. And you don't need to do that. Once the trade is on, it's going to do what it's going to do. It doesn't need you to be supervised. It. And I think if you obsess over it, you put it this way, if you look hard enough, you'll see anything.
Oh yeah.
And I think you've got to put a bit of air between you and the trade and just have a plan to follow.
So you mentioned prior before, which I really liked, was the notion of scaling up and scaling down. Now this is a way to be more objective. So this is when we talk about record keeping and your ratios, like your sharp ratio, edge ratio, win-loss ratio, average profit, average loss, and so forth. How do you tabulate that to make an informed decision?
Look, you have to have good record keeping, and it's an area, I think, again, that can become quite deficient for a lot of wannabe self-directed traders. And what I mean by that, the actual final hard and fast record keeping is going to be done on your trading platform in terms of what the P&L looks like. But that's only one measure of tools. And if you sort of take a bit of a look at and think about business for a moment, you know, with a business, most people would say, oh, you know, the only thing that matters is that you make a profit at the end of the year. And that's not strictly true, because when you're running a business, you've got to have a balance sheet. You've got to know where your assets and liabilities sit. You've got to have cash flow statements to know what the cash flow looks like within the business. And if you're managing your assets correctly and you're managing your cash flow at the end of the year, you'll probably make a profit. But if you were just looking at the profit and you were unable to see what the working parts were behind it, that can be a challenge. So if we use that in a trading scenario, your trading platform is going to have your P&L, but it's not going to have any of the attribution, the analysis as to how that profit was derived. And I think keeping a separate series of records whereby you can look on a buy strategy basis, okay, this is how effective I've been at choosing my trades, and the win-loss ratio might be a good example. That's not an ideal ratio, but nonetheless, it does add some value. And then once you've started to get a bit of an edge and you're finding good quality trades, it's now how do you actually manage the effectiveness of those trades to ensure that your profit is better than your losses when you get it wrong. So let's say you're right 7 out of 10 times, and when you're right, you make 5%. But on those 3 out of 10 times when you're wrong, you lose 20%. You've got a negative strategy, even though you're picking more winners than losers, which would then point you down the pathway of you need to look at your risk management, because that's what's causing you the drama here.
I like that, yeah.
And so all of a sudden, just like an accountant would look at the cash flow within a business and be able to identify where you might have some choke points, very quickly as a trader coach, you can dive in and spot, okay, this is where the first challenge then sits. So, you know, looking at things like that, I think to scale, having an equity curve is really important, which is basically the P&L of your account. I'd suggest if you use different strategies, maybe some are geared and some aren't, you have separate equity curves. So let's say you're doing covered calls or cash on demand, that's in one equity curve. And then if you're doing something that's a little more aggressive, like spreads, for example, that's in a separate set of records. Why? Well, the return on a spread might be 30 or 40%, which is going to be, you know, 10 or 12x what you'd make on a covered call. So it's going to create a lot of volatility in that.
Gotcha.
Smooth it up. Second to that, I like to put a moving average on that equity curve then. And then if the equity curve is above my moving average, then I'll scale up. And if it's trending the other way, that's where I'll scale down. And then what it does, it removes that, oh, it doesn't feel like my trading's going well, what should I do? You've actually got an objective set of measures to
really nice.
Hit the gas or hit the brakes, yeah.
Now, one thing that we speak of a lot to our clients, which will add into strategies for overcoming this, is perspective.
Mm.
And there's really three areas within perspective, i.e. having the right goal to mm-hmm. begin with, doing critical reviews, and then shifting if you need to, which may even include stepping back from your trading. What are your thoughts on those three key areas?
Absolutely crucial. You've ginned up well for this. You've
prepared. You know me.
When you look at the three steps, the obvious thing when you talk to anyone that's an investor is say, what's your goal? And they're going to say, to make a profit, Andrew. It's as obvious as anything, but is it the right goal? And the answer to that is no. It's not the right initial goal. It's an important goal, but it's not the major one. When you're starting out on this journey, and actually no, not when you're just starting out, but while you're on this journey always, the first goal is always going to be consistency. And by that, it might be getting that win-loss ratio improved. It might be learning how to manage when to take profit or when to cut your losses, but being very consistent with that. And the idea of that consistency is that will then bleed across and enable you to grow in confidence. And it's only when you become confident in something that you're going to scale up, and that's where you're going to make money. And it's a bit like learning to swim. You know, you don't jump in at the deep end and say, I'm going to be the gold medal butterfly swimmer. You've got to learn to swim first. You've got to get in the shallow end. You've got to see what it feels like to be in the water. You've got to see what it feels like to swallow water when you don't mean to. And then over time, as your confidence improves, you move down the pool to the deep end. And then that's where things really kick on. And trading in that respect is key. So profit, yes, of course, it's an overarching goal, but the steps involved with getting there start with consistency and then confidence.
Yeah.
If we look at the market as it stands right now, not wishing to date this podcast, you know, we are at all-time highs across, you know, everything from crypto to the major indices. And a lot of people have made some good money in that run up, and it's just been pure luck. And I hate to say that because they've opened a broking account, they've put money in, but it's been quite fortunate with their timing. And when this market gets a little bit choppier, if they haven't taken the time to build a process and learn how to be consistent and confident, that confidence will be decimated immediately because they're going to see their profit move. And that's not good. So that's one thing. The second part you mentioned was that ability to do reviews. And I think it's extremely important to look at your trades in the rearview mirror. And after they're completed, really go through and say, what were the essence of the positive elements of this? Or if there were negative elements, what in essence went wrong? Was it timing? Was it view? And they are different, even though that you can say, look, I was right. It just didn't happen at the right time. You've got to be quite objective with these things. Was my entry signal wrong? Was my exit signal wrong? Did I miss a huge news point or a data series that clobbered it? And the idea from that then is that even if it's not been a good trade financially, it's been a good learning experience for you because you won't make that mistake. At least I hope you don't make that mistake again, second, third, fourth time.
Gotcha.
And so you're improving your system, but journaling is, and doing a trade review is very important. And it's, again, easy just to go, oh, that was another good trade and forget about it. But the more you can learn about what made it a good trade, the more you can do those kinds of trades. And equally on the other side of the coin, if you had an absolute shocker and made a mistake, by acknowledging and understanding what that mistake is, you can eliminate it from your trading plan.
Got you. Last one on then before we move into some examples was shifting and taking a step back.
Mm.
Now, if I can share a personal example on this, I went through a really rough trot with my trading at one stage. Mm-hmm. And I remember my partner at the time said, Mitch, don't put too much pressure on yourself. Just take a week off.
Mm.
And I did. I didn't do any trades for a whole week. And I must say the mental clarity I had when I came back was so much better because when you're in that stage, if you've had a couple of losing trades, you can really make some bad decisions.
You can, but you could call it revenge trading almost when something owes you some money or you've had a bad run. And that motivation is a very toxic motivation. Nothing good comes from toxic
Never.
Motivation. And so there's a lot of merit in giving a bit of a space or a breather in there. I've always taken the view that you know, if you come back and you want to be hungry to get back into something, that shows that you're in the right area of your life, whether that be, you know, let's say you had a sabbatical from training for a, can't imagine you're not hitting the gym for a week, but, you know, if you've had a week off, you'd be hungry to get back in there and eager to get started. And that motivation is very pure and it's very important. I think on the other side of the coin for other personality types, the notion of having time off, a week can suddenly become 2 weeks, which becomes a month, which becomes a quarter, which becomes a year, and then it's not something you do anymore. And so an alternate way of approaching that, again, down to personality type, would be, is not to stop entirely, is to totally scale things right down. So the wheels are still turning, you're still in the process, but the financial implications of those processes, if it goes wrong, it's nothing. It's $50, $100, as opposed to, you know, thousands of dollars. And if it works and you only made $30 or $40 instead of $3,000 or $4,000, it's going to give you a bit of a kick up the pants to get yourself back in the game. And I've used that sort of handbrake, that chokehold, a couple of times. I had a client in the US a while ago, very, very successful business person, and was what he self-confessed sports trader. So for him, it's just significance and recognition. It's like, if anyone makes a profit, I'll make more. If anyone makes a loss, I'll lose more. It's just, money didn't matter.
Interesting.
He's very wealthy.
Okay.
And that was partly his personality makeup. So I scaled him right back. And when I say scaled back, he'd go from doing an average position size of probably $400,000 or $500,000 on a trade to $2,000, and he hated
it. That would
have
killed him.
Because what's the point?
Yeah.
And the point is to get the discipline back so that you literally can ease back into this by getting so frustrated. I think you've got to have 8 wins at this level before I'll open the door up, and you can move your position size up a notch and a notch and a notch. And that's what we did to get him back, and got great consistency and long-term success for him. But at the time, the medicine didn't taste too good for him, because I'm missing out on making all this. It's like, yeah, but you're also missing out on doing all of that. So we've got to backfill and get some good habit and behavior in here, so we're building a stronger and more firm foundation.
Do you know, actually reminds me of an episode we did many years ago. It was called Walk, Crawl, Run. You might remember that. I think it was August 2020 from memory.
There we go. That's the mist of time. So we're a few years into this podcast series, that's for sure. Yeah, I do remember that one now.
I was going to say, if you're a listener who maybe experiences much the same, go and have a listen to that, because we specifically talk about this in that episode.
There you go. And I might go back and have a refresher on that. I remember doing the podcast. I can't believe that's 4 years ago. That's crazy.
I wonder if my voice had broken that many years ago. Anyway, okay, parking that to the side. So some practical examples.
I was about to say something. It's okay.
Yeah, I know what you're about to say. Practical examples as we finish up here. And I want to do two. So let's go through an example where you yourself have experienced some poor display of trading psychology, and then an example of good display, because we're honest here. We want our clients to learn.
Okay. And these are in recent times. So listen to me, like 9 years ago, I made this blunder. And I think, the idea of doing this is, there's a lot of pressure when you're a coach or a mentor to people. You know, they can sometimes put you up on a pedestal. We're also human. And we, to the best of our endeavors, have acquired huge amounts of skill, but it's still possible to fall foul of some of these. And for me, if I look back, I've got a trade running at the moment, and one of the portfolios on VIXI, which is the volatility index. Now, VIXI is interesting insofar as we've got a scenario right now, and again, without wishing to date this podcast, that we've got two wars going on, serious wars in different parts of the world. We've got interest rate / inflation debates going on as to whether rates are going to get cut or not, and some of the inflation figures are firmer than was expected. And that sort of ebb and flow of whether or not rates are likely to change soon is there. We've got election cycles in, I think, 66% of the world's population goes to the polling booth this year. Countries like India, South Africa, the UK, US, of course, which is massive, possibly here in Australia, we'll see. And these are all factors that should create some, China going into a possible recession, Japan in a recession, UK in a recession. So there's some really significant events going on at the moment. Yet from a volatility perspective, nobody cares. So there's this enormous disconnect, and this was probably the biggest millstone around my trading last year, between technicals, fundamentals, and what's actually going on. No one's paying any attention to the fundamentals. And so with equity markets at all-time highs, volatility typically drops. So I'm in a trade there where volatility has just been literally like a leaf falling out of a tree, drifting lower and lower and lower. I mean, this trade could have, should have cut it ages ago. My view is that volatility is going to spike, which will give a great exit for that, and we're able to go bank some profit and go home for cake and medals and put that one in the rearview mirror and do quite a deep dive on what went wrong with the exit on that. But that's an example of something I've held on to, because my view is that vol will spike, which it will.
So is this an endowment effect example, would you call it?
I don't think it's an endowment effect. I think I've just become, I'm not going to say belligerent in my view on that. It just makes no sense based on 30 plus years of experience in markets why vol will be dropping in the way that it is. That said, it is. My view has been wrong, and I've got to wait for it to become right. Earlier on, I gave myself a get out of jail card, which, like, sometimes is it your view that's wrong or your timing? Well, my view's right, but my timing's wrong. Let's play that card. So here's an example, and I don't think it's not an endowment effect. I think it's just that disconnect that's in markets that's wrong-footed me, and then I've not managed it in the way that I probably should.
Fair enough. Appreciate the honesty. That's awesome. Let's go through a good example now as we finish off on a high note.
A good example. Had a trade running on that. We did some advertising about if you've got 30 grand sitting in the bank rather than, you know, 4.5%, which would be negative after inflation, here's how you can get that money working. So we used NAB as the share as well as the bank account in the example. And my goal at the start of that trade, I said, I want to keep this trade open. And it's in the advert. The advert was in, I think, May of last year. And so I think about 2 million people have seen it. So a lot of people have seen that.
Holy smokes.
A lot of people had a lot to say about rubbish, scam, con, and all the rest of it. And so I thought, I'll keep this trade running. I want to prove a point here, which is ideally not the best motivation for something. So I've been in the trade. I've closed out of it. It closed, 15.9% for 7 months. So I didn't stay in it for a year.
Nice.
I got to 16, give or take, 0.1%, if you can forgive me for that.
Round up for that.
And I did it in 7 months.
Nice.
And so it proved a point. Throughout that time, we used protection, had the war in Gaza. The starters, we bought some protection, which took a little bit of the profit out of the trade by buying that protection, but it also enabled us to protect it. And for me, I was quite happy to see that trade closed out, because I don't trade a lot of Australian equities, as you know. And the only reason I was in NAB was to corroborate that advert and prove a point. And again, I think it's a positive and it's a profitable trade, which is fantastic, point proven. We know what we're doing, and it was a good strategy. But the motivation behind it was just literally that, to, all right, let me show you how to do this. And I don't think that's a particularly good attribute to take into a trade. I'd much prefer it to have been a more, I'll take the trade of its own volition rather than try and prove a point with it. And I think that would have changed some of the decision-making I made in there. I probably would have kept it open longer if it was a trade I actually wanted to be in. But I hit the goal of what I had. Now I just want this gone so I can refocus on my strategy, having done what I've done. So it's easy to, I mean, that's a positive, but is it a great story? I don't know that it necessarily is, because my motivation wasn't right. Yes, it's profitable, which then ties back to that whole thing. If you're looking at a company, you don't just look at the P&L. Yes, it was profitable. Brilliant. Well done. Company was profitable. Brilliant. But you've got to look at a little bit deeper behind that when you're doing your reviews, to go, look, whilst it was profitable, it's probably not a great idea to keep doing that sort of thing. And,
gotcha.
And that's just as it is, you know, cards on the table, off the shoulder, no filter, they're real trades. And so it does show what a threat psychology and mindset can have all the way through this in terms of clouding your decision-making.
Indeed. And I can imagine your trading journals too would reflect much the same, probably in a lot more detail as well.
Yeah. I think sometimes when you have a real soul search, and I'll be really interested when I dive into that VIXIE trade. And go through that. And that might be something that's actually merits its own sideshow in terms of a podcast, because I think when it's raw like this, and it's hopefully this stuff is helpful for people, because it's such a lonely business. It's trading is about solitude. It's you and your account. It's not you versus the market. It's you versus you.
Indeed.
But it's you and your account at the end of the day. And I guess having these kinds of conversations, which perhaps ecosystem, our listeners have also been through, will help them to realize they're not going mad. Why is this happening to me? These are all normal things for people that are in this space, whether they're a 30 plus year veteran like me, or whether you're Joe Bag of Donuts that walked in the door yesterday. And being aware of them and working on, I guess, processes to remove yourself from the decision-making and let the process do its thing is something that brings enormous peace of mind and ultimately, I think, enormous profit.
Indeed. Process over emotion any day of the week. AB, cracking episode. I feel like our listeners will get a lot out of that. So thank you very much.
Awesome. Thanks very much, Mitch. Anytime. There you go, guys. Make sure you like, comment, subscribe. Most importantly, hit the notification button, and we'll look forward to hosting you next week.